I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valley stair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man.
Excellent.
Hi.
Welcome to Barnstorming. Thank you so much. My name is Taylor Lightman.
Glad to be here with you.
One of your good co-hosts here, we're happy to have here. You know him. You love him. Jordy Comas, my co-producer, co-host, and good friend. Welcome, Jordy. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here, and this is the second person we were interviewing in the very important Democratic Senate primary campaign. And I'll turn it over to Representative Lamb. Just because we're short on time,
To the pod.
Welcome to the pod. Yes. Go ahead. Would you like to introduce yourself, Representative Lamb?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you guys for having me. I'm Connor Lamb. I'm in a car traveling across our great state right now. I'm a candidate for the United States Senate. I'm a United States Marine and former prosecutor, current representative of the 17th District of Pennsylvania out in the suburbs of Pittsburgh.
Excellent. And Pennsylvania, or certainly anybody with cable television, was introduced to you back in 2017 when you ran this incredible dark horse candidacy for Congress. And it was just incredible to watch. And so it's just a pleasure having you on the scene and seeing you run for higher office. So it's good to have you on the pod. And thanks for tossing your name in.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. So, for those that are not familiar, you actually come from a family of public servants. And, you know, did you have like a specific politicizing moment that got you into politics, or was it kind of just the next step for you? Could you tell us a little about your decision to, serve Pennsylvanians and get into politics?
Sure. I think I was raised with the expectation that, you know, we would give back in some way. And in my family, a couple of people have done that through politics. Others, you know, I have two siblings that are teachers. And so we've sort of done it a bunch of different ways. I was working in the United States Attorney's Office in Pittsburgh as a prosecutor following a few years in the military, where I also was a prosecutor in military courts martial. And as time went on, I was focusing a lot on heroin investigations, heroin overdose deaths, heroin trafficking, and that sort of thing. And it just sort of hit me head on the way that so much of Western Pennsylvania had really been hollowed out and affected by the opioid epidemic. And it was like all these towns that I had sort of heard of and even been to and played high school basketball in growing up. And I knew that they were supposed to be these big Democratic bastions. And when a lot of them voted for Trump in 2016, it just really bothered me, because I felt like our community was having these serious public health and economic problems. And I knew for sure that Trump wasn't going to do anything to help. And so I felt like, you know, some of my friends and neighbors had been defrauded. And that ultimately is what really made me want to make the leap into Congress to see if I could help turn things around from where they had been after 2016.
You had mentioned that you're from Western Pennsylvania, you grew up there. But, you know, Pennsylvania's are like a really diverse state. How do you bridge that gap between people that maybe don't share your specific background and create a unbreakable solidarity politics, you know, to come together?
Well, I think it's the issues that unite us the most at the end of the day. You know, I found that when I was going out in that first campaign and trying to get the votes of people who had voted for Trump. And, you know, there's a whole species out there of like Obama, Trump, Lamb voters, of people that were just kind of looking for change. The issues that bound us together were, one, they just kind of wanted new leadership across the board. They were willing to take a chance on a young guy who was new. But secondly, things like protecting and strengthening and expanding Social Security and Medicare are such wildly popular issues, even with very, very conservative people in our state. And issues like that can sort of help us build a bridge toward the center or toward the right. And I would say, you know, now that I'm in a Democratic primary and I'm encountering a lot of different types of Democrats all across the state, I see that, you know, my advocacy on those issues, as well as advocacy on issues like the future of energy policy in this country and the infrastructure that we're building and climate change, you know, really can be a bridge across our party in the other direction, because, you know, some people are very focused on carbon reduction, climate change policy. Others, like in the building trades and the labor unions, for example, are just focused on the jobs that we're going to create. But the issues are what sort of bring us together more so than the personalities or the style, I think.
I just want to rewind a little bit to something you were saying about your earlier involvement in the opioid epidemic. And I guess one thing, you know, in my experience is the ways in which our country has dealt with illegal drugs and the problems of health and crime that brings on, it shifted a lot. And so when the opioid epidemic swept across primarily white rural Pennsylvania, I think in a healthy way, attitude shifted. But I think it's reasonable for people who have loved ones who have been in prison for, you know, marijuana, especially, or for other things, to feel like there's sometimes maybe a double standard. And when drug addiction is seen as a public health problem, and when it's seen as a public menace that needs to be policed. Can you understand, like, why people might see that as a double standard? And what would you say to them?
In general, I think that they're right. I think that the opioid epidemic was treated with a lot of sympathy when it was a white people problem, or perceived that way. It no longer really is just a white people problem, by the way. I mean, there have been, I think someone told me, 6 overdose deaths in the city of Philadelphia for every gun death that there have been in the past year. Opioids are showing up in all sorts of illegal drug combinations. And so I think it's a valid critique. That where we need to go with criminal justice policy and drug policy, I think, is to focus a little bit more on gun violence and preventing gun violence and treating drug addiction like the brain disease that it is, and doing what we can to give people that are suffering from that disease the treatment and resources that they need, whether they were introduced to an illegal drug in North Philadelphia or in Greene County, which I represented. It doesn't matter. Everybody should deserve the chance to come back from something like that. I think that the challenge is that I'm not sure our society really has faced up to what that is going to cost and what it's going to mean. You know, it can take someone a year or longer to break an addiction to an opioid, for example, and it requires a lot more than just a few meetings with a doctor. It requires inpatient treatment and rehabilitation, job placement. I mean, I've seen it be successful, but it's not cheap. Now, I think it's pay now or pay later, because when you don't make that investment up front, people die and other people's lives are ruined. And that's an incalculable cost that we should never accept in a society as wealthy as ours.
It, Representative, you brought up, I mean, there's a lot of things there that we could go off of, but like something that I think is really integral to both what you just said and to the Democratic Party and the Democratic brand in general is, you know, Democrats are, we're the party of healthcare. What specific reforms do you think would, like, really deliver a better healthcare system for Americans?
Well, I'm a very practical person in this regard. So I try to look at, you know, what changes have we made that have actually delivered results for Americans already, and maybe we can build on that momentum. So that's why I really try to stay focused on the basic framework of the Affordable Care Act and how we can continue to improve it. You know, and your listeners who are really in the know will know that the American Rescue Plan that we passed when Joe Biden came into office really was largely a healthcare bill that made the Affordable Care Act subsidies a lot more generous. For the first time, capped out-of-pocket costs for people based on their income. And those are all going to expire at the end of this year. So that's a big part of what's on the line in this Senate race. But I think for me, you know, when people talk about Medicare for All, it's one of those issues that I think if you were, like, starting America over today from scratch, you would look at the successful example that so many other countries have of these single payer systems and try to model it. But I don't think that our society really is that way for a whole lot of reasons that we probably don't want to go into. And that's, to me, why I see that, you know, somebody wrote down Medicare for All in a statute in 2006, and it never has moved one inch in 16 years. It hasn't given healthcare to anybody in that time. Whereas the Affordable Care Act has protected and taken care of tens of millions of people. So to me, it's a choice that's about kind of being progressive, defined more by the results than by the, you know, by the Twitter posts about it, I guess.
Yeah, I'm respectful of that. And I mean, like, would you support an option to buy into Medicare instead of a private insurer? Is that something that you think is a realistic reform?
I think it could be. I have been supportive of the idea of a public option before, which could take the form of buying into Medicare. I've also been supportive of various proposals to lower the Medicare age. And one of the interesting versions of those proposals is one where people could buy into Medicare at age 50. So it's not exactly the same as Medicare now, because when you turn 65, you're just on it. This is something that maybe at 50, you'd get the option to buy in. Lowering the Medicare age is very expensive. So that was something I worked on this year with the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, actually a woman named Pramila Jayapal. She and I had a meeting with Speaker Pelosi trying to get her to put a lower Medicare age into the Build Back Better Act. And the reason we didn't get it in there is because the number of dollars was basically capped for healthcare, and you got a little bit more bang for your buck for people on coverage when it came to subsidizing the ACA plans versus lowering the Medicare age. So that, those are some of the trade-offs you can be up against when you're actually kind of pushing these bills over the finish line. But it's something I've worked on, and I'm definitely open to.
A couple years ago, this was part of me. You know, I moved to Pennsylvania. I lived here about half my life, but I read about something. I think it's called the Pennsylvania Club or the Pennsylvania Society. They meet in Manhattan and they have like a big dinner. I'd never heard of it, but it's in New York, but it's called the Pennsylvania Club.
I think it's the Pennsylvania Society or something.
Pennsylvania like Society, yeah. I was just curious if you heard of it. This isn't a trick question, but have you heard of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been in New York while that has been going on. I've never been to the actual dinner or event itself, but yeah, I'm aware of it.
I mean, isn't it a kind of an amazing thing? Like, what struck me was, and I'll get to the opioid epidemic, but like in my mind, it sort of clicked that, especially in the rural areas, I haven't been to your part of the state, but I think it's similar from what I've read. We live on these landscapes that are basically the landscapes that have been shaped by past extraction industries, right? And the Pennsylvania Society was a lot about that. It, you know, from what I read, it was, you know, 100 years or more dating to when Pennsylvania was in many ways a resource colony for New York financial capital. So, you know, we have timber, which is something that's affected where Taylor and I live, coal, which is areas near us, the fracking industry. But also for me was like, from what I've heard about Purdue Pharmaceutical and what they were doing and the ways it was, the opioid epidemic wasn't like an accident, but it was a thing that was really designed to pump up profits. Like there, instead of mining a natural resource, it was a human resource, right? It was human frailty. So I was wondering, like, is that a sort of understanding of Pennsylvania's history? Like, would you accept that as a premise? And then do you think that shapes the way in which we need a politics of people and a politics of responding? Because, like, the extraction industries come and go, but the people and the towns and the sort of social networks, this is what I always notice, they're more durable, right? Like, we're here again, right, for, like, one more round of extraction.
So I think that the opioid part of your question may be a bridge too far for me, just because I've never really encountered anyone from Purdue Pharma or the guilty companies, at least having an origin in Pennsylvania. If I'm wrong about that, let me know. But
an origin, but they were able to.
They definitely preyed on our people. So that part of it, I get. I definitely share your concerns about the landscape, the resources, the effect on the people. I think what I see as someone that represents in particular a lot of areas where they have drilled for natural gas is the fact that you're dealing with a lot of people who really are living paycheck to paycheck and want to stay in their town. And so, you know, if jobs have left your town over time, and the one thing that comes along that offers a union wage, good benefits, is the chance to build a pipeline or a compressor station, or now in the middle of my congressional district, the Shell cracker plant, which is the largest single investment in Pennsylvania since World War II. You know, people are going to take it, and they should take it. They want to provide for their families. Now, I think natural gas has a lot of costs and benefits. And so while it is extractive, one thing you could look at is, you know, once you extract it, what becomes of it? What do? It does heat people's homes. It does give them electricity. It does those things while emitting half of the CO2 that coal does. So that's one benefit of it, is that it actually has eroded the market share of coal and helped a little bit with CO2 emission as a result of that. It also appears to be able to have some downstream manufacturing potential. You know, people think of plastics, like single-use plastics, like water bottles and stuff, as something that we want to cut back on, which I agree with. But if you talk to the maker of a Tesla automobile, for example, you know, they would tell you that they need a lot of these ethylene components to make their cars light enough to be able to run on electricity alone. So it's all a little bit more interrelated than I think people realize, in kind of the way that the steel industry was the backbone of so many of these communities. Yes, it was extractive in the sense that it relied on coal. It was also very productive in the sense that it allowed us to enter a world market and, you know, access wealth and resources all over the world. And so that in Western Pennsylvania, you know, the average job 45 years ago was a $35 or $40 an hour steel job. Today, it's a $13 an hour healthcare job. And the reason is not only because of the decline of the labor movement, it's also because the product itself is very different in terms of who it can be sold to and how much wealth it can generate. And so I guess it's all a way of saying that, you know, I'm not going to block or go against an industry just because it's quote unquote extractive. What I'm going to try to do is make sure that my constituents get the best possible benefit of it in terms of jobs and economics, and that we are always applying the best possible regulations, you know, in the case of energy, to try to get a decarbonized energy system as fast as possible. Especially because of the immediacy of the needs that people have. You know, they need their next paycheck, not one in 10 years. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I kind of think about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think I wasn't interested in sort of labeling extractive industries as good or bad guys, but probably, and I think you might agree with this, more how it's handled from a policy perspective and sort of in the long view. The people in the towns and the communities that are built have much longer lifespans. So, you know, I think this coincides with where you were headed, which is we need government is really like, this is a key role for government, is to step in and to make sure that the rules of the game benefit everyone. And, you know, I maybe am more pessimistic than you that there's a long history of not doing enough, so that it's okay to be extremely vigilant or look with a skeptical eye at what's being proposed these days.
Yeah, Representative, you did correctly mention that natural gas is seen by many as a bridge fuel because it emits so much less, methane emits so much less carbon emissions than coal and other types of more carbon intensive energy production sources. How do you see us hitting our ambitious climate goals outlined in the Paris Accord?
So here's what I would say. I agree that we need to get to net zero by 2050. And that's a pretty tall order, given that I think the amount of CO2 equivalent we emit every year in the world is about 58 billion tons. So that's, to go from 58 billion tons to zero is difficult, but I agree with you. I mean, I have a one-year-old son and we're about to have a second child in June. I'm thinking they're going to be hopefully alive until 2100 or later.
Congratulations. That's so exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So it is personal, you know, like it is for a lot of people. How do we meet it? I think of these things as let's do whatever is decarbonizing at a level we can actually afford that is realistic and sustained. And let's be, you know, I was on President Biden's campaign task force on energy and climate change. He added both me and Representative Ocasio-Cortez to it to show sort of two young people passionate about this with slightly different perspectives. And one of the phrases that we kept using in our report was technology neutral. So natural gas is a really good example. A lot of people may be skeptical about using it because it is a fossil fuel. Well, it is a lot cheaper than coal and emits half as much CO2 as coal. So if the addition of more natural gas to the grid 10 years ago actually meant that we used less coal, that is a technologically neutral way of lowering carbon emissions, and it's part of our portfolio. It's also good for people listening to this to know that in other places in the world, California and Germany are two really good examples, the more that they added just purely solar and wind to the grid, they ended up having to burn more fossil fuels. In Germany's case, it was coal. In California's case, it was natural gas. But that's because we still haven't invented the batteries yet that are capable of storing all that solar and wind energy long enough to be able to rely on just those sources. We're getting better at that. But if you talk to the people in the government who really know this, we're a decade or more away from a battery of that type. So a lot of what we need to do is continue to innovate battery technology, a next generation of nuclear technology that is cheap enough for us to build and add more carbon-free power to the grid that way. And then there's an entire segment of things that we do every day that is not electricity related. It's manufacturing of steel, asphalt, cement, ammonia, like manufacturing processes that rely right now mostly on the burning of coal or other fossil fuels and are very, very difficult to electrify. And so that's where hydrogen as a fuel source is going to probably become very important. And that's something I've tried to focus a lot on in Congress. We could be the first place in the world to make steel out of hydrogen reliably. Hydrogen could also power freight locomotives. We have experiments within the Department of Defense to power aircraft with hydrogen. So you're taking heavily fossil fuel emitting activities and you would take them down to zero if you made that hydrogen in a certain way. All of that is going to require massive, massive federal research and development investment. And I always just like to remind people, we've done this in American history at least twice before. Once was with the Manhattan Project to become the first in the world to get nuclear energy. And with the way the Manhattan Project worked, it was as large as the United States auto industry at its height in terms of the number of people that were employed, buildings, factories, all that. And then we turned around and did it again in the 1960s with the Apollo program and the space race. So this is harder than both of those things combined, but we do have this paradigm of a very heavy federal research investment and employment, connection with industry, connection with labor. And that's where, you know, people may think of me as a centrist or a moderate in a lot of ways. In this one, there's no way to do this on the cheap. I am sort of unabashedly a big government person when it comes to taking on these technological and innovative challenges, because I think there's no other way to do it. No company is ever going to have the sense of urgency that it's going to require to get these technologies to where they need to be.
Well, just to follow up on that, I think you're right. And I think part of it's also the sort of risk tolerance, if we were to use that language, right, for a company to take on the kind of long-term uncertain risks, it's really hard for them to do. I don't know the numbers like you do, but it seems to me some life science projects have been pretty comparable in scale, like the sequencing of the human genome around the turn of the century, turn of the 21st century there was a whole government side. And even more recently, you know, the work in mRNA vaccines, there seems to me some of that was also came from government labs. I may be wrong in it, but I was just saying,
scale. No, we're very good. We're very good at this. This particular problem, I think, is different because it crosses so many different domains. But you're exactly right that we have a great history of this and we should be proud of it and we should be building on it to take on. And we probably, I mean, frankly, the United States is probably going to have to invent a lot of things that the rest of the world will use because of our capacity to innovate and fund these types of things. So, you know, we're only 15% of emissions at the end of the day. So 85% of it is elsewhere. And if we don't deal with the elsewhere as well, the planet's in big trouble. So.
Yeah, and it presents a huge opportunity for us economically as well, which I think people don't understand for some reason. A huge emitter for us is transportation. I know Representative Moulton has sponsored a number of bills about high-speed rail and introducing that and bolstering Amtrak in other ways. Is that passenger rail something that you would support?
You know, yes. I don't want to overpromise on that one just because if you look at the economics, building new passenger rail in America is incredibly expensive. It's more expensive than most places in the world. And that's why, you know, Japan and Europe and all these other places have so much more of it than we do. So I don't tend to look at that as like a major component of where we're going, but it is something I favor. I mentioned something that's happening in Western Pennsylvania. There's a collaboration happening between a company called Wabtec and some scientists at CMU. And we're trying to get them some federal funding, basically to create a hydrogen-powered locomotive for freight rail. So a lot of our economy still is carried around every day on freight railroads, and they have to carry very, very heavy loads. And they've invented these fuel cells that can be run on hydrogen. And they actually already have one model example, but to get it right, you have to continue to iterate and refine. And we're trying to get, Senator Casey and I are working together to try to get some money for that. So I think defossilizing the freight rail sector would be huge, and maybe even a bigger impact than passenger.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just, you've got me so curious now about the hydrogen, and I'm sorry if I'm betraying a shocking lack of ignorance, but where does the hydrogen come from?
Well, that's the big question, actually. So it is, there are many ways to make hydrogen. If you had enough cheap green electricity, you could take water and basically get the hydrogen molecules out of it.
Right.
And you would have hydrogen. Right now in America, a lot of people that use hydrogen take natural gas, which is CH4 is the molecule, and they just kind of rip off the carbon and then there you've got hydrogen, but they emit the carbon.
Whoa. So chemistry is outside of the bounds of this podcast. We do no chemistry.
Oh, sorry.
On no. I'm
just
kidding.
Saying, so that's
I love
a,
it.
That's
we love
a
it.
Fossil
we love it.
Fuel, you know, polluting way of making hydrogen that is not what we want to use. And so part of the innovation required to make that shift is to figure out ways to make hydrogen at cost. Like, they know right now how to make it with a bunch of solar panels and water, but it's way too expensive. And so people are experimenting with, like, could you hook something like that up to a nuclear reactor and get a lot more electricity at a lower cost with no carbon emissions? And so that's part of what we did in the infrastructure bill, actually, is we're going to create 4 hydrogen hubs around the country funded by the Department of Energy that are going to figure out exactly these types of problems.
That's super cool. And I'm excited to see what that is or how that plays out. Representative, I think there has been kind of a framing of this race as maybe more ideological left versus right. But I mean, I'm of the opinion that it's much more complicated than that. What do you see this race as being? What is this Democratic primary race about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a degree to which that's true because, you know, particularly John's past positions in support of Medicare for All and, you know, strong supporter of Senator Sanders' presidential campaign and everything, it clearly does place him to the left of where I am, at least on that major policy issue of healthcare. But I agree with you that I think it's a little bit more about maybe the way in which we communicate with and connect with voters. And I think John, to his credit, is very skilled at communicating with the Democratic base, especially through social media. And he's very popular as a result. And you can see it in the fundraising and everything. My concern all along has been that there's just there's a larger world you have to step into once you're the nominee. And you have to be able to appeal to people who really are not liberals. Like, swing voters in Pennsylvania, for the most part, are not liberals. And you can look at the 2020 election results when on the same exact ballots that we elected Joe Biden, we elected 2 other Republicans statewide, and Republicans made gains in the legislature and all that. Those are the kind of people that I've spent the last 4 years around. I know how they talk. I know how they think. I've gotten them to vote for me. I really haven't changed any of my positions along the way. I think it's more of a question of focus and how you present yourself and their feeling that you're in it to represent them too. And I also, I've always thought my military background helped a lot with those sorts of people. That's what they would always tell me. So, you know, I try to encourage Democrats to think right now, not just about sort of how we make you feel day to day as a Democratic-based voter, but we have this shared mission of going out and trying to, you know, have a bigger tent and build a coalition through the rest of the year in order to win what's going to be a very difficult race. And the fact that I've done that before under a big spotlight, you know, I think qualifies me to be the one to be our nominee.
You know, rural areas, my experience having lived in Union County for 20 years and looking, I've looked pretty carefully at 2016 and 2020 presidential results and some others too. You know, the rural areas are often where statewide races are won or lost. You know, Biden's margin, of course, Philly and Pittsburgh were absolutely essential in some of the other large cities, but the difference between how he performed in 2016, you know, like Trump overperformed in 2020, for example, in Philly, was a lot of counties that are sort of medium-sized city, like Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, where I happen to be now, and then rural areas, some real surprises, like Monroe County, which is on the border of New Jersey.
Montour County, I think, went
Montour
10,
County
10 points or something like that towards Biden.
Right. So anyway, don't let us get too in the weeds because we'll geek out about it. But as somebody in, you know, who's, I've been on my Democratic committee, I'm on my borough council as an elected Democrat in Lewisburg. I feel like rural areas often provide the margin, and I'm really sort of digging into sort of within party stuff. But like between cycles and in general, there's such a perpetual problem of underinvestment, so much underinvestment, and so that's usually done on the backs of all volunteer labor. And then we end up with situations like I know in the 15th, the congressional district, which I've been put into now, no one made the ballot, for example. No one had enough sort of ground game to get on the ballot to challenge Glenn Thompson. So I'm wondering what you know, and as the senator, you'll be one of the leaders, it seems to me, of the Pennsylvania Party. Like, do you have ideas about what we can do to stop that decline? Because I think it's, you know, for election strategies to continue to count on super high turnout in larger urban areas, and I think some of your own electoral campaigns point to this, that's a losing strategy. You can only squeeze so many votes out of, you know, the collar counties in the Southwest urban areas. So I've kind of rambled on a little bit, but you know, that's the core of it. It's like, if you're a senator, what can you do as a party leader to help us reverse this trend?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking to someone who was elected with a bunch of extra votes in Greene County, Washington County, Westmoreland County. So I know exactly what you mean. And, you know, I've always considered it on a personal level just important to keep faith with those people who really stuck their neck out and helped me in some pretty tough territory in 2018 and afterward. And, you know, we used to have to replace people's yard signs, you know, pretty much on a weekly basis because they were either getting ripped down or having trash thrown on them or all the rest. But these were people who, you know, the Clinton campaign in 2016 tried to charge them for yard signs. And I always thought, you know, we should be paying you to put up a yard sign in a lot of these areas, given how unpopular and dangerous it can be. So, you know, I think clearly funding.
Just real quick, in Mifflin County, I think, was it 2019 or 2018? Actually, a barn was burned down that had a Biden sign, and they tracked the arsonist down to some people who were politically motivated. So I just like to throw that out.
It's real. It's real. And so I guess all I'm trying to say is, for me, my very first experience in politics was dealing with this problem that you're talking about. And I've always thought it's best, if you want to be a leader on a larger scale, to listen to the people on the ground and what they need. And so I've always tried to be a contributor to my local party committees, even in the toughest areas, and come to every event, give money, spend time with the local candidates, trying to help them raise their profile. And that's the kind of leader I would be as your senator. You know, we get access as Senate candidates to pretty amazing networks when it comes to fundraising. And I think we could all probably do a better job of investing that with real people on the ground in a lot of these communities, instead of just sort of hoarding it all for TV commercials, which are important, but you have to strike a balance if you want to be a leader, I think.
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer, and thank you for that.
Can I just pitch an idea real quick, Taylor, and then we'll do rapid fire? So this is an idea I've had, and you don't have to commit to it, but just since, you know, I've got the luxury of your ear for a second, I've always imagined, you know, we have these models. Let's say for a given county, I'll pick one, Snyder County, the target, you know, for your race, if you're the nominee, is, you know, 39% for Connor Lamb. Like, I've always thought that the state party could say to those kinds of counties, if you get above that, right, we will commit to investing money in your local capacity building up, you know, programs, right? So you can have, like, my county committee put some money into a part-time organizer just to help, you know, in between cycles. So, like, you know, you can give that a thumbs up or a thumbs down if you like. But to me, that's the kind of thing, like, let's not just rely on, like, the bully pulpit and exhorting people. Let's actually show them that the party will invest in them if they overperform targets for statewide races.
One more idea.
No, that's perfect.
One more idea is a small, like, micro grants for counties offered by the state party. But you've been very generous with your time, and we have a few more questions there. Rapid fire questions.
These are the fun ones.
These are the fun ones. Okay. Yeah. So I'm a blank Democrat. How do you feel on that?
Pennsylvania.
Name a mentor that you've had, someone who's been a mentor to you, and what does that say about you?
Oh, good one.
While you're thinking, I'll point out that one thing I find really disturbing about Donald Trump is he doesn't have an answer to that. Mark Cuban actually pointed that out.
That he doesn't have any sort of mentor?
Right. Mark Cuban was talking about how, you know, wealthy people who actually earn their wealth always talk about a mentor they've had, and Trump never does.
Yeah. I'll give you the first one that kind of pops into my head. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I clerked for this federal judge up in New York, who, I don't know if he's registered with a political party or not. He was a Republican appointee, but career public servant. He was a federal prosecutor. That was how I ended up with him, because that was what I wanted to be. And when you work as a federal prosecutor in New York City, you can leave after a few years and make literally millions of dollars a year. And he never did that. He has six kids, and he was so passionate about public service that he stayed as a prosecutor. And then he got appointed to the bench as one of the youngest federal judges in the country. And so I keep in touch with him. He has literally never owned a house. He's been renting a house his entire adult life, raising six kids, serving now as a federal appeals court judge, because he was so passionate about working in the government and trying to do the right thing for people. And he was just so fair to every single person that came in front of him. Even though I'm not practicing as a lawyer anymore, I think about him all the time in terms of his dedication and the sacrifice he was willing to make to, because the government is a special calling. You know, people badmouth the government all the time, but they do a lot of really important work. So he was a mentor of mine and still is.
What is something that you have in your junk drawer that you think everybody should have? And what's something that's in your junk drawer that, like, you need to get rid of?
Oh, man. Well, I'll give you a Marine Corps answer. We think the answer to 99% of problems is duct tape. So I've got a lot of duct tape laying around the house in various places, and you'd be surprised how many things you can fix with that. So including like wounds, first aid, you can duct tape those, you know, I mean, you can duct tape just about anything. So that's what I'd give you.
Excellent. Well, you heard it here. Representative Lim, how can people find out about your campaign? How can they follow your journey?
They can follow us on social media. I'm pretty easy to find. Website, ConnorLamb.com. I have a lot of policy positions on there and information about how I voted in the past and what my ideas are. And actually, we have the whole thing translated in Spanish as well. So we didn't talk about this, but I think a really important thing for our state party is to really reach out to the Latino Spanish-speaking immigrants that are moving into Pennsylvania, especially in the eastern side of the state. So I've been trying to make that a priority as well.
I'll tell you what, also, if you can find it, Hindi translation for Scranton, you'd be shocked how many people who are native Hindi speakers.
Oh, great.
If it comes down to 1,000 votes, you heard it from me.
Yeah.
Representative Lim, thank you so much for coming. It's been a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's listen, you know, win or lose, you know, I think we, Taylor and I both known a lot of people who've run and really impossible to win races in rural areas. And I always like to say, like, and you know, I've only run for very small things, but like, it's not easy. It's not easy to put yourself out there. It's a huge amount of work. I can't even begin to fathom. A lot of car time, a lot of carbs. Like, I'm shocked at how healthy and fit you look. I'm a little jealous. But anyway, no, but from the heart, like, you know, I think we need to always embrace each other and lift each other up, you know, no matter what happens. And I always like to say, I believe in a left that organizes people and fights ideas, not the other way around.
Good. Well, I appreciate you guys coming and having me on and everything that you're doing. And I guess we'll see you out there on the trail. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.